This is Audible.
Scholastic Audio presents Refugee by Alan Gratz. Read by Michael Goldstrom, Kyla Garcia, and Asaf Cohen.
Joseph, Berlin, Germany, 1938.
Crack! Bang!
Joseph Landau shot straight up in bed, his heart racing. That sound, it was like someone had kicked the front door in, or had he dreamed it? Joseph listened, straining his ears in the dark. He wasn't used to the sounds of this new flat, the smaller one he and his family had been forced to move into. They couldn't afford their old place, not since the Nazis told Joseph's father he wasn't allowed to practice law anymore because he was Jewish. Across the room, Joseph's little sister, Ruth, was still asleep. Joseph tried to relax. Maybe he'd just been having a nightmare. Something in the darkness outside his room moved with a grunt and a scuffle. Someone was in the house. Joseph scrambled backward on his bed, his eyes wide. There was a shattering sound in the next room. Krish! Ruth woke up and screamed in sheer blind terror. She was only 6 years old. Mama! Joseph cried. Papa! Towering shadows burst into the room. The air seemed to crackle around them like static from a radio. Joseph tried to hide in the corner of his bed, but shadowy hands snatched at him, grabbed for him. He screamed even louder than his little sister, drowning her out. He kicked and flailed in a panic, but one of the shadows caught his ankle and dragged him face first across his bed. Joseph clawed at his sheets, but the hands were too strong. Joseph was so scared he wet himself, the warm liquid spreading through his nightclothes. No! Joseph screamed. No! The shadows threw him to the floor. Another shadow picked up Ruth by the hair and slapped her.
Be quiet!
The shadow yelled, and it tossed Ruth down on the floor beside Joseph. The shock shut Ruth up, but only for a moment. Then she wailed even harder and louder.
Hush, Ruthie, hush, Joseph begged her.
He took her in his arms and wrapped her in a protective hug.
Hush now.
They cowered together on the floor as the shadows picked up Ruth's bed and threw it against the wall.
Crash!
The bed broke into pieces. The shadows tore down pictures, pulled drawers from their bureaus, and flung clothing everywhere. They broke lamps and light bulbs. Joseph and Ruth clung to each other, terrified and wet-faced with tears. The shadows grabbed them again and dragged them into the living room. They threw Joseph and Ruth on the floor once more and flicked on the overhead light. As Joseph's eyes adjusted, he saw the seven strangers who had invaded his home. Some of them wore regular clothes, white shirts with the sleeves rolled up, gray slacks, brown wool caps, leather work boots. More of them wore the brown shirts and red swastika armbands of the Sturmabteilung, Adolf Hitler's stormtroopers. Joseph's mother and father were there, too, lying on the floor at the feet of the brown shirts.
"Joseph! Ruth!"
Mama cried when she saw them. She lunged for her children, but one of the Nazis grabbed her nightgown and pulled her back.
"Aaron Landau," one of the brown shirts said to Joseph's father, "you have continued to practice law despite the fact that Jews are forbidden to do so under the Civil Service Restoration Act of 1933. For this crime against the German people, you will be taken into protective custody."
Joseph looked at his father, panicked.
"This is all a misunderstanding," Papa said. "If you'd just give me a chance to explain..."
The brown shirt ignored Papa and nodded at the other men. Two of the Nazis yanked Joseph's father to his feet and dragged him toward the door.
"No!"
Joseph cried.
He had to do something.
He leaped to his feet, grabbed the arm of one of the men carrying his father, and tried to pull him off. Two more of the men jerked Joseph away and held him as he fought against them. The brown shirt in charge laughed.
"Look at this one," he said, pointing to the wet spot on Joseph's nightclothes. "The boy's pissed himself."
The Nazis laughed, and Joseph's face burned hot with shame. He struggled in the men's arms, trying to break free.
I'll be a man soon enough, Joseph told them. I'll be a man in 6 months and 11 days. The Nazis laughed again.
6 months and 11 days, the brown shirt said. Not that he's counting.
The brown shirt suddenly turned serious.
Perhaps you're close enough that we should take you to a concentration camp too, like your father.
No, Mama cried. No, my son is just 12. He's just a boy. Please, don't.
Ruth wrapped herself around Joseph's leg and wailed,
Don't take him! Don't take him!
The brown shirt scowled at the noise and gave the men carrying Aaron Landau a dismissive wave. Joseph watched as they dragged Papa away to the sounds of Mama's sobs and Ruth's wails.
Don't be so quick to grow up, boy, the brown shirt told Joseph. We'll come for you soon enough.
The Nazis trashed the rest of Joseph's house, breaking furniture and smashing plates and tearing curtains. They left as suddenly as they had come, and Joseph and his sister and mother huddled together on their knees in the middle of the room. At last, when they had cried all the tears they could cry, Rachel Landau led her children to her room, put her bed back together, and hugged Joseph and Ruth close until morning. In the days to come, Joseph learned that his family wasn't the only one the Nazis had attacked that night. Other Jewish homes and businesses and synagogues were destroyed all over Germany, and tens of thousands of Jewish men were arrested and sent to concentration camps. They called it Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass. The Nazis hadn't said it with words, but the message was clear. Joseph and his family weren't wanted in Germany anymore. But Joseph and his mother and sister weren't going anywhere. Not yet. Not without Joseph's father. Mama spent weeks going from one government office to another, trying to find out where her husband was and how to get him back. Nobody would tell her anything, and Joseph began to despair that he would never see his father again. And then, 6 months after he'd been taken away, they got a telegram. A telegram from Papa. He'd been released from a concentration camp called Dachau, but only on condition that he leave the country within 14 days. Joseph didn't want to leave. Germany was his home. Where would they go? How would they live? But the Nazis had told them to get out of Germany twice now, and the Landau family wasn't going to wait around to see what the Nazis would do next.
Isabel. Just outside Havana, Cuba. 1994. It took only 2 tries to get the scrawny calico kitten to come out from under the pink cinder block house and eat from Isabel Fernandez's hand. The cat was hungry, just like everyone else in Cuba, and its belly quickly won out over its fear. The cat was so tiny it could only nibble at the beans. Its tummy purred like an outboard motor, and it butted its head against Isabel's hand in between bites. "You're not much to look at, are you, kitty?" Isabel said. Its fur was scraggly and dull, and Isabel could feel the cat's bones through its skin. The kitten wasn't too different from her, Isabel realized, thin, hungry, and in need of a bath. Isabel was 11 years old, and all lanky arms and legs. Her brown face was splotchy with freckles, and her thick black hair was cut short for summer and pulled back behind her ears. She was barefoot, like always, and wore a tank top and shorts. The kitten gobbled up the last of the beans and mewed pitifully. Isabel wished she had something else to give it, but this food was already more than she could spare. Her lunch hadn't been much bigger than the cat's, just a few beans and a small pile of white rice. There had been rationing and food coupon books back when Isabel was little, but a few years ago, in 1989, the Soviet Union had fallen, and Cuba had hit rock bottom. Cuba was a communist country, like Russia had been, and for decades the Soviets had been buying Cuba's sugar for 11 times the price, and sending the little island food and gasoline and medicine for free. But when the Soviet Union went away, so did all their support. Most of the farms in Cuba grew only sugar cane. With no one to overpay for it, the cane fields dried up, the sugar refineries closed, and people lost their jobs. Without Russia's gas, they couldn't run the tractors to change the fields over to food, and without the extra food, the Cuban people began to starve. All the cows and pigs and sheep had been slaughtered and eaten. People had even broken into the Havana Zoo and eaten the animals, and cats like this little kitten had ended up on dinner tables. But nobody was going to eat this cat.
"You'll just be our little secret," Isabel whispered.
"Hey, Isabel,"
Ivan said, making her jump. The cat skittered away underneath the house. Ivan was a year older than Isabel and lived next door. He and Isabel had been friends as long as she could remember. Ivan was lighter skinned than Isabel, with curly dark hair. He wore sandals, shorts, a short-sleeved button-down shirt, and a cap with a fancy letter I on it, the logo of the Havana baseball team, the Industriales. He wanted to be a professional baseball player when he grew up, and he was good enough that it wasn't a crazy dream. Ivan plopped to the dusty ground beside Isabel.
"Look! I found a bit of dead fish on the beach for the cat."
Isabel recoiled at the smell, but the kitten came running back, eating greedily from Ivan's hand.
"She needs a name," Ivan said.
Ivan gave names to everything, the stray dogs who wandered the town, his bicycle, even his baseball glove.
"How about Jorge, or Javier, or Lázaro?"
"Those are all boy names," Isabel said.
"Yes, but they are all players for the Lions, and she's a little lion."
The Lions was the nickname of the Industriales.
"Ivan,"
his father called from next door.
"I need your help in the shed."
Ivan climbed to his feet.
"I have to go. We're building a doghouse," he said, before sprinting away.
Isabel shook her head. Ivan thought he was being sneaky, but Isabel knew exactly what he and his father were building in their shed, and it wasn't a doghouse. It was a boat. A boat to sail to the United States. Isabel was worried the Castillos were going to get caught. Fidel Castro, the man who ruled Cuba as president and prime minister, wouldn't allow anyone to leave the country, especially not to go to the United States, El Norte, as Cubans called it, the North. If you were caught trying to leave for El Norte by boat, Castro would throw you in jail. Isabel knew that because her own father had tried and had been thrown in jail for a year. Isabel noticed her father and grandfather heading down the road toward the city to stand in line for food. She put the little kitten back under her house and ran inside for her trumpet. Isabel loved tagging along on trips into Havana to stand on a street corner and play her trumpet for pesos. She never did make much, not because she wasn't good. As her mother liked to say, Isabel could play the storm clouds from the sky. People often stopped to listen to her and clap and tap their feet. But the only people who could afford to give her pesos were the tourists, visitors from Canada or Europe or Mexico. Ever since the Soviet Union had collapsed, the only currency most Cubans had were the booklets you got stamped when you went to pick up your food rations from the store. And food ration booklets were pretty worthless anyway. There wasn't enough food to go around, whether you had a booklet or not. Isabel caught up with her father and grandfather, then parted ways with them on the Malecón, the broad road that curved along the seawall on Havana Harbor. On one side of the road were blocks of green and yellow and pink and baby blue homes and shops. The paint was peeling and the buildings were old and weathered, but they still looked grand to Isabel. She stood on the wide promenade, where it seemed all of Havana was on display. Mothers carried babies in slings. Couples kissed under palm trees. Buskers played rumbas on guitars and drums. Boys took turns diving into the sea. Tourists took pictures. It was Isabel's favorite place in the whole city. Isabel tossed an old ball cap on the ground, on the off chance that one of the tourists actually had a peso to spare. She lifted the trumpet to her lips. As she blew, her fingers tapped out the note she knew by heart. It was a salsa tune she liked to play, but this time she listened past the music, past the noise of the cars and trucks on the Malecón,
past the people talking as they walked by, past the crash of the waves against the seawall behind her. Isabel was listening for the clave underneath the music, the mysterious hidden beat inside Cuban music that everybody seemed to hear except her. An irregular rhythm that lay over the top of the regular beat, like a heartbeat beneath the skin. Try as she might, she had never heard it, never felt it. She listened now, intently, trying to hear the heartbeat of Cuba in her own music. What she heard instead was the sound of breaking glass.
Mahmoud, Aleppo, Syria, 2015. Mahmoud Bishara was invisible, and that's exactly how he wanted it. Being invisible was how he survived. He wasn't literally invisible. If you really looked at Mahmoud, got a glimpse under the hoodie he kept pulled down over his face, you would see a 12-year-old boy with a long, strong nose, thick black eyebrows, and short, cropped black hair. He was stocky, his shoulders wide and muscular, despite the food shortages. But Mahmoud did everything he could to hide his size and his face, to stay under the radar. Random death from a fighter jet's missile or a soldier's rocket launcher might come at any moment, when you least expected it. To walk around getting noticed by the Syrian army or the rebels fighting them was just inviting trouble. Mahmoud sat in the middle row of desks in his classroom where the teacher wouldn't call on him. The desks were wide enough for three students at each, and Mahmoud sat between two other boys named Ahmed and Nedal. Ahmed and Nedal weren't his friends. Mahmoud didn't have any friends. It was easier to stay invisible that way. One of the teachers walked up and down the hall ringing a handbell, and Mahmoud collected his backpack and went to find his little brother, Walid. Walid was 10 years old and 2 grades below Mahmoud in school. He too wore his black hair cropped short, but he looked more like their mother, with narrower shoulders, thinner eyebrows, a flatter nose, and bigger ears. His teeth looked too big for his head, and when he smiled, he looked like a cartoon squirrel. Not that Walid smiled much anymore. Mahmoud couldn't remember the last time he'd seen his brother laugh, or cry, or show any emotion whatsoever. The war had made Mahmoud nervous, twitchy, paranoid. It had made his little brother a robot. Even though their apartment wasn't far away, Mahmoud led Walid on a different route home every day. Sometimes it was the back alleys. There could be fighters in the streets who were always targets for the opposition. Bombed-out buildings were good, too. Mahmoud and Walid could disappear among the heaps of twisted metal and broken cement, and there were no walls to fall on them if an artillery shell went whizzing overhead. If a plane dropped a barrel bomb, though, you needed walls. Barrel bombs were filled with nails and scrap metal, and if you didn't have a wall to duck behind, you'd be shredded to pieces. It hadn't always been this way. Just 4 years ago, their home city of Aleppo had been the biggest, brightest, most modern city in Syria, a crown jewel of the Middle East. Mahmoud remembered neon malls, glittering skyscrapers, soccer stadiums, movie theaters, museums. Aleppo had history, too, a long history. The old city, at the heart of Aleppo, was built in the 12th century, and people had lived in the area as early as 8,000 years ago. Aleppo had been an amazing city to grow up in. Until 2011, when the Arab Spring came to Syria. They didn't call it that then. Nobody knew a wave of revolutions would sweep through the Middle East, toppling governments and overthrowing dictators and starting civil wars. All they knew from images on TV and posts on Facebook and Twitter was that people in Tunisia and Libya and Yemen were rioting in the streets, and as each country stood up and said, "Enough!" so did the next one, and the next one, until at last the Arab Spring came to Syria. But Syrians knew protesting in the streets was dangerous. Syria was ruled by Bashar al-Assad, who had twice been elected president when no one was allowed to run against him. Assad made people who didn't like him disappear, forever. Everyone was afraid of what he would do if the Arab Spring swept through Syria. There was an old Arabic proverb that said, "Close the door that brings the wind and relax." And that's exactly what they did. While the rest of the Middle East was rioting, Syrians stayed inside and locked their doors and waited to see what would happen. But they hadn't closed the door tight enough. A man in Damascus, the capital of Syria, was imprisoned for speaking out against Assad. Some kids in Daraa, a city in southern Syria, were arrested and abused by the police for writing anti-Assad slogans on walls. And then the whole country seemed to go crazy all at once. Tens of thousands of people poured into the streets, demanding the release of political prisoners and more freedom for everyone. Within a month, Assad had turned his tanks and soldiers and bombers on the protesters, on his own people. And ever since then, all Mahmoud and Walid and anyone else in Syria had known was war. Mahmoud and Walid turned down a different rubble-strewn alley than the day before and stopped dead. Just ahead of them, two boys had another boy up against what was left of a wall, about to take the bag of bread he carried. Mahmoud pulled Walid behind a burnt-out car, his heart racing. Incidents like this were common in Aleppo lately. It was getting harder and harder to get food in the city. But for Mahmoud, the scene brought back memories of another time, just after the war had begun. Mahmoud had been going to meet his best friend, Khalid. Down a side street just like this one, Mahmoud found Khalid getting beaten up by two older boys. Khalid was a Shia Muslim in a country of mostly Sunni Muslims. Khalid was clever, smart, always quick to raise his hand in class, and always with the right answer. He and Mahmoud had known each other for years, and even though Mahmoud was Sunni and Khalid was Shia, that had never mattered to them. They liked to spend their afternoons and weekends reading comic books and watching superhero movies and playing video games. But right then, Khalid had been curled into a ball on the ground, his hands around his head while the older boys kicked him.
"Not so smart now, are you, pig?" one of them had said. "Shia should know their place. This is Syria, not Iran."
Mahmoud had bristled. The differences between Sunnis and Shiites was an excuse. These boys had just wanted to beat someone up. With a battle cry that could have made Wolverine proud, Mahmoud had launched himself at Khalid's attackers. And he had been beaten up as badly as Khalid. From that day forward, Mahmoud and Khalid were marked. The two older boys became Mahmoud's and Khalid's own personal bullies, delivering repeated beatdowns between classes and after school. That's when Mahmoud and Khalid had learned how valuable it was to be invisible. Mahmoud stayed in the classroom all day, never going to the bathroom or the playground. Khalid never answered another question in class, not even when the teacher called on him directly. If the bullies didn't notice you, they didn't hit you. That's when Mahmoud had realized that together, he and Khalid were bigger targets. Alone, it was easier to be invisible. It was nothing they ever said to each other, just something they each came to understand. And within a year, they had drifted apart, not even speaking to each other as they passed in the hall. A year after that, Khalid had died in an airstrike anyway. It was better not to have friends in Syria in 2015. Mahmoud watched as these two boys attacked the boy with the bread, a boy he didn't even know. He felt the stirrings of indignation, of anger, of sympathy. His breath came quick and deep, and his hands clenched into fists. "I should do something," he whispered. But he knew better. Head down, hoodie up, eyes on the ground. The trick was to be invisible, blend in, disappear. Mahmoud took his younger brother by the hand, turned around, and found a different way home.
Joseph. Berlin, Germany, 1939. One day from home. It was like they were invisible. Joseph and his sister followed their mother through the crowd at the Leerter Bahnhof, Berlin's main railway station. Joseph and Ruth each carried a suitcase, and their mother carried two more, one for herself and one for Joseph's father. No porters rushed to help them with their bags. No station agents stopped to ask if they needed help finding their train. The bright yellow Star of David armbands the Landaus wore were like magical talismans that made them disappear. Yet no one bumped into them, Joseph noticed. All the station attendants and other passengers gave them a wide berth, flowing around them like water around a stone. The people chose not to see them. On the train, Joseph and his family sat in a compartment labeled J for Jew, so no real Germans would sit there by accident. They were headed for Hamburg, on the north coast, where his father would meet them to board their ship. The day they had gotten Papa's telegram, Joseph's mother booked tickets for all four of them to the only place that would take them, an island half a world away called Cuba. Ever since the Nazis had taken over 6 years ago, Jews were fleeing Germany. By now, May of 1939, most countries had stopped admitting Jewish refugees or had lots of official applications you had to fill out and file and pay for before they would let you in. Joseph and his family hoped to one day make it to America, but you couldn't just sail into New York Harbor. The United States only let in a certain number of Jews every year, so Joseph's family planned to live in Cuba while they waited. "I'm hot," Ruthie said, pulling at her coat. "No, no," her mother said. "You must leave your coat on and never go anywhere without it. Do you understand? Not until we reach Cuba."
"I don't want to go to Cuba,"
Ruth whined as the train got underway. Mama pulled Ruth into her lap.
"I know, dear, but we have to go so all of us will be safe. It will be an adventure."
Ruthie would have started kindergarten that year if Jews were still allowed to go to school. She had bright eyes, wild brown hair cut in a bob and parted on the side, and a little gap between her two front teeth that made her look like a chipmunk. She wore a dark blue wool dress with a white sailor's collar and carried her white corduroy stuffed rabbit, Bitsy, everywhere she went. Ruthie had been born the year Adolf Hitler was elected Chancellor of Germany. She'd never known any other life except this one. But Joseph remembered how it used to be. Back when people saw them. Back when they were Germans. They had gotten up early, and it had been a stressful day, and soon Ruthie was asleep in Mama's lap, and Mama dozed with her. As he watched them sleep, Joseph wondered if anyone would really be able to tell they were Jews, if they weren't in a Jewish compartment, wearing armbands with the Star of David on them. Joseph remembered a time in class, back when he was allowed to go to school. His teacher, Herr Meyer, had called him to the front of the room. At first, Joseph thought the teacher was going to ask him to do a math problem on the board. Instead, Herr Meyer lowered a screen with the faces and profiles of Jewish men and women on it and proceeded to use Joseph as an example of how to tell a real German from a Jew. He turned Joseph this way and that, pointing out the curve of his nose, the slant of his chin. Joseph felt the heat of that embarrassment all over again, the humiliation of being talked about like he was an animal, a specimen, something subhuman. Without these stupid armbands, without the letter J stamped on his passport, would anyone know he was Jewish? Joseph decided to find out. He left the compartment quietly and walked along the corridor past the other Jewish families in their compartments. Beyond the next door was the German part of the train. Heart in his throat, skin tingling with goosebumps, Joseph took the paper armband with the Star of David off his arm, slid it into the inside pocket of his jacket, and stepped through the door. Joseph tiptoed down the corridor. The German train car didn't feel any different than the Jewish car. German families talked and laughed and argued in their compartments, just like Jews. They ate and slept and read books like Jews. Joseph caught his reflection in one of the windows. Straight brown hair, slicked back from his pale white forehead, brown eyes behind wire-frame glasses that sat on a short nose, ears that stuck out maybe a little too far. He was about average height for his age, and he wore a gray, double-breasted pinstripe jacket, brown trousers, and a white shirt and blue tie. Nothing about him actually matched the pictures on Herr Meyer's presentation on how to identify a Jew. Joseph couldn't think of any Jewish people he knew who did look like those pictures. The next car was the dining car. People sat at little tables, smoking, eating, and drinking as they chatted or read the newspaper or played cards. The man at the concession stand sold newspapers, and Joseph took one and put a coin on the counter. The concession stand man smiled.
"Buying a paper for your father?" he asked Joseph.
"No," thought Joseph. "My father just got out of a concentration camp."
"No, for me," Joseph said instead. "I want to be a journalist one day."
"Good,"
the news agent said. "We need more writers." He waved a hand at all the magazines and newspapers.
"So I have more things to sell?"
He laughed, and Joseph smiled. Here they were, talking like two regular people. But Joseph hadn't forgotten he was Jewish. He hadn't forgotten that if he were wearing his armband, this man wouldn't be talking and laughing with him. He'd be calling for the police. Joseph was about to leave when he thought to buy Ruthie a piece of candy. Money had been tight since their father lost his job, and she would enjoy the treat. Joseph took a hard candy from a jar and fished in his pocket for another pfennig. He found one, put it on the counter, and paid for the candy. But when he'd removed the coin, his armband had slipped out too. It fluttered to the floor, the Star of David landing face up for all the world to see. A fist closed around Joseph's heart, and he dove for the armband.
Stomp!
A black shoe covered the armband before Joseph could grab it. Slowly, shakily, Joseph lifted his eyes from the black shoes to the white socks, brown shorts, brown shirt, and red Nazi armband of a Hitler youth. A boy about Joseph's age, sworn to live and die for the fatherland. He stood on Joseph's armband, his eyes wide with surprise. The blood drained from Joseph's face. The boy reached down, palmed the armband, and took Joseph by the arm.
"Let's go,"
the boy said, and he marched Joseph back through the dining car. Joseph could barely walk. His legs were like lead, and his eyes lost their focus. After Herr Meyer had called him in front of the class to show how Jews were inferior to real Germans, Joseph had returned to his seat next to Klaus, his best friend in the class. Klaus had been wearing the same uniform this boy did now. Klaus had joined the Hitler Youth not because he wanted to, but because German boys, and their families, were shamed and mistreated if they didn't. Klaus had winced to show Joseph how sorry he was that Herr Meyer had done that to him. That afternoon, a group of Hitler youth were waiting for Joseph outside the school. They fell on him, hitting and kicking him for being a Jew, and calling him all kinds of names. And the worst part was, Klaus had joined them. Wearing that uniform turned boys into monsters. Joseph had seen it happen. He had done everything he could to avoid the Hitler youth ever since, but now he'd handed himself right over to one, and all because he'd taken off his armband to walk around a train and buy a newspaper. He and his mother and sister would be put off the train, maybe even sent to a concentration camp. Joseph had been a fool, and now he and his family were going to pay the price.
Isabel, Havana, Cuba, 1994. Isabel opened her eyes and lowered the trumpet from her lips. She was sure she had just heard the sound of breaking glass, but cars and bicycles kept streaming by under the bright sun on the Malecón like nothing had happened. Isabel shook her head, convinced she was hearing things, and put her lips back to her trumpet. Then suddenly a woman screamed, a pistol fired, pack, and the world went crazy. People rushed out of the side streets, hundreds of them. They were men, mostly, many of them shirtless in the 100-degree August heat, their white and brown and black backs glistening in the sun. They yelled and chanted. They threw rocks and bottles. They spilled into the streets, and the few policemen on the Malecón were quickly overwhelmed. Isabel saw the glass window of a general store shatter, and men and women climbed inside to steal shoes and toilet paper and bath soap. An alarm rang. Smoke rose from behind an apartment building. Havana was rioting, and her father and grandfather were somewhere right in the middle of it.
Some people fled from the chaos, but more people raced toward it, and Isabel ran with them. Car horns beeped. Bicycles swung around and pedaled back. People were as thick on the ground as sugar cane. Isabel weaved in and out among them, her trumpet tucked under one arm, looking for Papi and Lito.
"Freedom! Freedom!"
chanted some of the rioters.
"Castro out! Enough is enough!"
Isabel couldn't believe what she was hearing. People caught criticizing Fidel Castro were thrown into jail and never heard from again. But now the streets were full of people yelling,
"Down with Fidel! Down with Fidel!"
"Papi!"
Isabel cried.
"Lito!"
Her grandfather's name was Mariano, but Isabel called him Lito, short for Abuelito, Grandpa. Rifles boomed, and Isabel ducked. More police were arriving by motorcycle and military truck, and the protest was turning bloody. The rioters and police traded rocks and bullets, and a man with a bloody head staggered past Isabel. She reeled in horror. A hand grabbed her, making her jump, and she spun around. Lito. She threw herself into her grandfather's arms.
"Thank God you're safe," he told her.
"Where's Papi?"
she asked him.
"I don't know. We weren't together when it started,"
her grandfather said. Isabel thrust her trumpet into his arms.
"I have to find him."
"Chavela!"
her grandfather cried. He used her childhood nickname, like he always did.
"No! Wait!"
Isabel ignored him. She had to find her father. If he was caught again by the police, he'd be sent back to prison. And this time, they might not let him out. Isabel dodged through the crowds, trying to stay away from where the police had formed a line.
"Papi!"
she called.
"Papi!"
But she was too short, and there were too many people. High above her, Isabel saw people climbing out onto the big electric sign hanging from the side of a tourist hotel, and it gave her an idea. She worked her way to one of the cars stuck in the riot, an old American Chevy with chrome tail fins, still around from before the revolution in the 1950s. She climbed up the bumper and onto the hood. The man behind the steering wheel honked his horn and took the cigar out of his mouth to yell at her.
"Chavela!"
her grandfather shouted when he saw her.
"Chavela, get down from there!"
Isabel ignored them both and turned this way and that, calling out for her father. There. She saw her papi just as he reared back and threw a bottle that smashed into the line of police along the seawall. It was the last straw for the police. At a command from their leader, they pushed forward into the crowd, arresting rioters and hitting them with wooden batons. In all the turmoil, a policeman caught up with her father and grabbed him by the arm.
"No!"
Isabel cried. She leaped down off the hood of the car and pushed her way through the pandemonium. When she got to her papi, he was balled up on the ground, and the policeman was beating him with his nightstick. The policeman raised his truncheon to hit her father again, and Isabel jumped in between them.
"No! Don't! Please!"
she cried. The policeman's eyes flashed from anger to surprise, and then back to anger. He reared back again to hit Isabel, and she flinched. But the blow never came. Another policeman had caught his arm. Isabel blinked. She recognized the new policeman. He was Luis Castillo, Iván's older brother.
"What do you think you're doing?"
the older policeman barked. Luis didn't have time to answer. A whistle blew. The police were being summoned elsewhere. The angry cop yanked his arm free from Luis and pointed his nightstick at Papi.
"I saw what you did,"
he said.
"I'll find you again. When all this is over, I'll find you and arrest you, and they'll send you away for good."
Luis pulled the angry policeman away, pausing just long enough to give Isabel a worried look over his shoulder. Luis didn't have to say anything. As her grandfather arrived, and helped Isabel get her father to his feet, she understood. Papi had to leave Cuba. Tonight.
Mahmoud, Aleppo, Syria, 2015. The afternoon adhan from a nearby mosque echoed through the bombed-out streets of Aleppo, the melodious, ethereal voice of the muezzin praising Allah and calling everyone to prayer. Mahmoud had been doing his math homework at the kitchen table, but he automatically put his pencil down and went to the sink to wash up. The water wasn't working again, so he had to pour water over his hands using the plastic jugs his mother had hauled from the neighborhood well. Across the room, Walid sat like a zombie in front of the television, watching a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cartoon dubbed into Syrian Arabic. Mahmoud's mother came out of the bedroom, where she'd been folding clothes, and turned off the TV. "Time to pray, Walid. Get washed up." Mahmoud's mother, Fatima Bishara, held her pink iPhone in one hand, and in her free arm, she carried Mahmoud's baby sister, Hannah. Fatima had long, dark hair she wore up on her head, and intense brown eyes. Today, she was wearing her usual around-the-house attire, jeans and a pink nurse's shirt she used to wear to work. She quit the hospital when Hannah was born, but not before the war had begun. Not before coming home every day with horror stories about the people she'd helped put back together. Not soldiers, regular people. Men with gunshot wounds. Women with burns. Children with missing limbs. She hadn't gone nearly catatonic like Walid, but at some point it had gotten bad enough that she just stopped talking about it. When he was finished washing up, Mahmoud went to the corner of the living room that faced Mecca. He rolled out two mats, one for him and the other for Walid. Their mother would pray by herself in her bedroom. Mahmoud began without Walid. He raised his hands to his ears and said, "Allahu Akbar, God is the greatest." Then he folded his hands over his stomach and said a brief prayer before reciting the first chapter of the Quran, the most holy book in Islam. He bowed and praised Allah again three times, stood and praised Allah again, then got down on his hands and knees and put his head to the floor, praising Allah three times more. When he was finished, Mahmoud sat back up on his knees and ended his prayers by turning his head right and then left, recognizing the angels who recorded his good and bad deeds. The whole prayer took Mahmoud about 7 minutes. While he'd been praying, Walid joined him. Mahmoud waited for his brother to finish, then rolled up their mats and went back to his homework. Walid went back to watching cartoons. Mahmoud was just starting a new equation when he heard a sound over the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles theme song. A roar like a hot wind rising outside. In the second it took for the sound to grow from a breeze to a tornado, Mahmoud dropped his pencil, put his hands to his ears, and threw himself under the kitchen table. By now, he knew what an incoming missile sounded like. Shh-thoom! The wall of his apartment exploded, blasting broken bits of concrete and glass through the room. The floor lurched up under Mahmoud and threw him and the table and chairs back against the wall of the kitchen. The world was a whirlwind of bricks and broken dishes and table legs and heat, and Mahmoud slammed into a cabinet. His breath left him all at once, and he fell to the floor with a heavy thud in a heap of metal and mortar. Mahmoud's ears rang with a high-pitched whine, like the TV when the satellite was searching for a signal. Above him, what was left of the ceiling light threw sparks. Nothing else mattered in that moment but air. Mahmoud couldn't draw a breath. It was like somebody was sitting on his chest. He thrashed in the rubble, panicking. He couldn't breathe. Couldn't breathe. He flailed wildly at the debris, digging and scratching at the wreckage, like he could somehow claw his way back to a place where there was air. And then his lungs were working again, raking in great gulps. The air was full of dust, and it scratched and tore at his throat as it went down. But Mahmoud had never tasted anything so sweet. His ears still rang, but through the buzz, he could hear more thuds and booms.
It wasn't just his building that had been hit, he realized. It was his whole neighborhood. Mahmoud's head was hot and wet. He put a hand to it and came away with blood. His shoulder ached and his chest still seared with every hard, desperate breath. But the only thing that mattered now was getting to his mother, his sister, his brother. Mahmoud pulled himself up out of the rubble and saw the building across the street in raw daylight, like he was standing in midair beside it. He blinked, still dazed, and then he understood. The entire outside wall of Mahmoud's apartment was gone.
Joseph. On a train to Hamburg, Germany, 1939. One day from home. The Hitler Youth led Joseph down the narrow corridor of the German passenger car. Tears sprang to Joseph's eyes. The brown shirt who'd taken his father away on Kristallnacht had said, "We'll come for you soon enough." But Joseph hadn't waited. He'd gone to them with this stupid stunt. They came to a compartment with a man in the uniform of the Gestapo, the Nazis' secret state police, and Joseph stumbled. The Gestapo man looked up at them through the window in his door.
"No, not here, not now, not like this," Joseph prayed, and the Hitler Youth boy pushed Joseph on past.
They came to the door of the Jewish train car, and the Hitler Youth spun Joseph around. He glanced over his shoulder to make sure no one was listening.
"What were you thinking?" the boy whispered.
Joseph couldn't speak. The boy thrust the armband at Joseph's chest.
"Put that on, and don't ever do that again," the Hitler Youth told Joseph. "Do you understand?"
Yes,
Joseph stammered.
"Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you."
The Hitler Youth breathed hard, his face red like he was the one in trouble. He spotted the piece of candy Joseph had bought for Ruth and took it. He stood taller, tugged at the bottom of his brown shirt to straighten it, then turned and marched away. Joseph slipped back into his compartment, still shaking, and collapsed onto his bench. He stayed there the rest of the trip, his armband securely in place and as visible as possible. He didn't even leave to go to the bathroom. Hours later, the train pulled in to Hamburg Central Railway Station. Joseph's mother led him and his sister through the crowds to the Hamburg docks, where their ship waited for them. Joseph had never seen anything so big. If you stood the ship on end, it would have been taller than any building in Berlin. Two giant tan smokestacks stuck up from the middle of the ship, one of them belching gray-black diesel engine smoke. A steep ramp ran to the top of the tall black hull, and hundreds of people were already on board, milling around under colorful, fluttering pennants and waving to friends and family down on the docks, flying highest above them all, as if to remind everyone who was in charge, was the red and white Nazi flag with a black swastika in the middle. The ship was called the MS St. Louis. St. Louis was the name of a city in America, Joseph had learned. That seemed like a good omen to him, a sign that they would eventually get to America. Maybe one day visit the real St. Louis. A shabby-looking man stumbled out from behind the crates and luggage piled up on the dock, and Ruthie screamed. Joseph jumped, and his mother took a frightened step back. The man reached out for them.
"You made it, at last!"
That voice, thought Joseph. Could it really be? The man threw his arms around Mama. She let him hug her, even though she still held her hands across her chest as if to ward him off. He stepped back and held her at arm's length.
"My dearest Rachel," he said, "I thought I'd never see you again." It was
him, the shabby man who had lurched from the shadows like an escapee from a mental asylum, was Joseph's father, Aaron Landau. Joseph shuddered. His papa looked nothing like the man who'd been dragged away from their home 6 months ago. His thick brown hair and beard had been shaved off, and his head and face were covered with scraggly stubble. He was thinner, too thin, a skeleton in a threadbare suit three sizes too big for him. Aaron Landau's eyes bulged from his gaunt face as he turned to look at his children. Joseph's breath caught in his throat, and Ruthie cried out and buried her face in Joseph's stomach as their papa pulled the two of them into a hug. He smelled so ripe, like the alley behind a butcher shop, that Joseph had to turn his head away.
"Joseph! Ruth! My darlings!"
He kissed the tops of their heads again and again, then jumped back. He looked around manically, like there were spies everywhere.
"We have to go. We can't stay here. We have to get on board before they stop us."
"But I have tickets," Mama said. "Visas."
Papa shook his head too quickly.
"It doesn't matter," he said.
His eyes looked like they were going to pop out of their sockets.
"They'll stop us. Take me back."
Ruthie clung to her brother. Papa was scaring her. He scared Joseph, too.
"Hurry," Papa said.
He pulled the family with him into the stacks of crates, and Joseph tried to keep up with him as he darted from place to place, dodging imaginary enemies. Joseph gave his mother a frightened glance that said,
"What's wrong with Papa?"
Mama just shook her head, her eyes full of worry. When they got close to the ramp, Papa hunkered down behind the last of the crates.
"On the count of three, we make a break for it," he told his family. "Don't stop. Don't stop for anything. We have to get on that ship. Are you ready? 1, 2, 3.
Joseph wasn't ready. None of them were. They watched as Aaron Landau ran for the ramp, where other passengers had already queued up to hand their tickets to a smiling man in a sailor's uniform. Joseph's father threw himself past the sailor and stumbled into the ramp's railing before righting himself and sprinting up the gangway.
"Wait!"
the sailor cried.
"Quickly now, children," Mama said.
Together, they hurried to the ramp as best they could, carrying all the suitcases.
"I have his ticket," she told the sailor. "I'm sorry, we can wait our turn."
The startled man at the front of the line motioned for them to go ahead, and Joseph's mother thanked him.
"My husband is just eager to leave," she told the sailor.
He smiled sadly and punched their tickets.
"I understand. Oh, let me get someone to help you with those bags. Porter?"
Joseph stood in wonder as another sailor, a German man without a Star of David armband, a man who wasn't a Jew, put a suitcase under each arm and one in each hand and led them up the gangway. He treated them like real passengers, like real people. And he wasn't the only one. Every sailor they met doffed his cap at them, and the steward who showed them to their cabin assured them that they could call upon him for anything they needed while on board. Anything at all. Their room was spotless, the bed linens were freshly laundered, and the hand towels were pressed and neatly stacked.
"It's a trick," Papa said when the door was closed.
He glanced around the little cabin like the walls were closing in.
"They'll come for us soon enough," he said.
It was just what the brown shirt had told Joseph. Mama put her hands on Joseph's and Ruthie's heads.
"Why don't you two go on up to the promenade?" she said softly. "I'll stay here with your father."
Joseph and Ruth were only too glad to get away from Papa. A few hours later, they watched from the promenade as tugboats pushed the MS St. Louis away from the dock, and passengers threw confetti and celebrated and blew tearful kisses goodbye. Joseph and his family were on their way to a new country, a new life. But all Joseph could think about was what terrible things must have happened to his father to make him look so awful and act so scared.
Isabel, just outside Havana, Cuba, 1994. Isabel and her grandfather set her papi in a chair in their little kitchen, and Isabel's mother, Teresa Padrón de Fernández, ran to the cabinet under the sink. Isabel hurried after her. Mommy was very pregnant. She was due in a week's time, so Isabel knelt down to find the iodine. Isabel's father, Geraldo Fernández, had always been a handsome man, but he didn't look it now. There was blood in his hair, and the area around one of his eyes was already turning black. When they pulled his white linen shirt off him, his back was covered with welts. Isabel watched as Mommy cleaned his cuts with a washcloth. Papi hissed as she disinfected them with the iodine.
"What happened?"
Isabel's mother asked. An Industriales baseball game played on the television in the corner, and Isabel's grandfather turned down the volume.
"There was a riot on the malecón,"
Lito said.
"They ran out of food too fast.
I can't stay here,
Papi said. His head was bent low, but his voice was loud and clear.
Not any longer. They'll come for me.
Everyone was quiet at that. The only sound was the soft crack of a bat and the roar of the crowd on the television. Papi had already tried to flee Cuba twice. The first time, he and three other men had built a raft and tried to paddle their way to Florida, but a tropical storm turned them back. The second time, his boat had a motor, but he'd been caught by the Cuban Navy and had ended up in jail. Now it was even harder to escape. For decades, the United States had rescued any Cuban refugees they found at sea and taken them to Florida, but the food shortages had driven more and more Cubans to El Norte. Too many. The Americans had a new policy everyone called wet foot, dry foot. If Cuban refugees were caught at sea with wet feet, they were sent to the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, at the southern end of Cuba. From there, they could choose to return to Cuba and Castro, or languish in a refugee camp while the United States decided what to do with them. But if they managed to survive the trip across the Straits of Florida and evade the U.S. Coast Guard and actually set foot on United States soil, be caught with dry feet, they were granted special refugee status and allowed to remain and become U.S. citizens. Papi was going to run away again, and this time, whether he got caught with wet feet or dry feet, he wasn't coming back.
There's no reason to go throwing yourself onto a raft in the ocean, Lito said. You can just lie low for a while. I know a little shack in the cane fields. Things will get better. You'll see.
Papi slammed a fist on the table.
And how exactly are they going to get better, Mariano? Do you think the Soviet Union is going to suddenly decide to get back together and start sending us food again? No one is coming to help us, and Castro's only making things worse.
As if saying